man. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Health Senate Healthcare Committee. It is February 2nd. And tomorrow, just to remind you, is Wear Red Day, Heart Awareness Day, so please wear red. I would like to open, I'm going to go a little bit out of order. I would like to...
We have to do rules first, don't we?
Yeah. Open, do I go into work session for rules?
Organizational.
Oh, okay. We're going to now organize. And so the rules have not changed from before. So,
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules.
Senator Steiner Hayward moves to adopt the committee rules. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? They are adopted. Now, can I move into
public
hearing? Okay, I would like to open a public hearing on. Can we go ahead and do this one?
Yeah, I didn't.
Senate Bill 1559. Is Mark Mayer here? Okay, we're going to do 1559, and since we've had basically our real heavy-duty public hearings, we now have a couple of amendments that are before us, the dash fours and the dash fives, and I would like Mark to actually explain them to us and then have the proponents of the amendments come after you do. After you give your spiel.
All right. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was asked to come down and briefly mention what's in the dash fours and the dash fives to preserve transparency. The dash four amendments are technical fixes to the bill. The first thing they do is they clarify that this license is only required for a business that's located in this state. It was brought to our attention that it could conceivably be construed to prohibit internet sales from locations out of the state. That wasn't the intent, of course, and so there's a minor fix there to clarify that. Then the second thing it does is currently all DOR appeals go to the tax court, even appeals related to non-tax related issues. And what this does is it clarifies that tax related issues are going to go to the tax court. Otherwise, if DOR decides to revoke a license, then that matter is going to go to a contested case hearing, as it would with most other licensing scenarios. So a little bit standardization of the law. Those are the technical fixes. The dash fives are a substantive fix. They don't amend the existing sections. What they do is they create three exemptions to the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act related to vaping. The first exemption is for businesses that primarily engage in the sale of inhalant delivery systems. Those are electronic cigarettes and other types of devices like electronic cigarettes. It allows people to sample there if the business is located at a premises for which a license has been issued. The business allows aerosolizing or vaporizing only for the purpose of sampling. The business does not allow aerosolizing or vaporizing of inhalants that contain nicotine or a cannabinoid. So these are flavors and to basically test the devices.
So they have no nicotine in them?
That's correct. To meet the exemption, it cannot have nicotine in the solution. And then no one under 18 can enter the store. And maximum seating capacity of 10 persons. We did include a little section here to kind of link up. The licenses won't be issued until January 1, 2017. So they don't have to have that license until the licensing program rolls out, as long as they meet the other criteria of the statute. So there's a bit of a gap between the effective date where they'll be able to sample and when the licensing scheme rolls out. The other two exemptions are simpler, and they deal with employees. The first one is a manufacturer of inhalant delivery systems, and I want to remind everybody here that this definition does include e-juice, because that's what the proponents were really aiming for. A manufacturer of e-juice by an employee of the manufacturer for purposes of testing the device. So if you're at one of these places and you're making this product, you'll be able to test it. And then at a business that engages in the sale for off-premises consumption or use of the e-cigarettes by an employee for the purpose of sampling. So my understanding is people come and they want to test the wares and stuff before they purchase them. You'd have to ask the proponents of that, but it only applies to the employees for sampling in those situations. And those are the two amendments.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate any questions of him at this point in time. We'll let you go and do some more amendments.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Colleagues, I would like to bring to your attention, since this is Steiner Hayward's bill and mine, that we have a problem with tobacco use in the state, and I wanted to bring to it, in fact, I was looking at the Lung Association's report card, and we are an F, the state is an F in three of the four categories. We're an F in tobacco prevention, we're F in tobacco taxes, we're an F in access to cessation services, but we are an A in smoke-free air in the state compared with when they compare all the states together. And part of that was the wonderful legislation that we passed last session that took e-cigarettes and put them into the Indoor Clean Air Act. So we have other issues that we need to take care of. This bill, the licensure bill, would require all retail licensees who sell tobacco to obtain a license. All retailers who sell tobacco obtain a license. And the number of youth has tripled in middle, high, and high school in using the inhalant delivery products that are out on the market. And that's why it's extremely important that we get a licensure bill first so that we know where, so that there is a better enforcement mechanism. Right now, we do not have a strong enforcement mechanism on all of these places that sell tobacco. I think I'll stop at that. Senator Steiner Hayward, do you want to just say anything, or should we start with the
I think I'd just like to add that many of you were involved in some extensive conversations on this issue during the 2015 session, and Senator Mona Sanderson did yeoman's work along with a wide array of stakeholders in this in the interim to get to a place where we could have pretty much everybody, I think, on board. What I'd like to remind everybody is of all the things Senator Mona Sanderson said, in addition to the fact that we know, as we'll be hearing from others, that the later we get that people start using tobacco or other nicotine-containing products, the less likely they are to become addicted and the less they'll use them in the course of their lifetimes. So anything we can do to decrease the use of these products is a good thing. And that while there is no such thing as a perfect bill, this one comes pretty darn close. People, it is not perfect. Everybody will probably find something not to love about it. That's probably the definition of a good bill. I consider this an enormous step in the right direction, which is one of the reasons I'm honored to co-chief sponsor this with Senator Mona Sanderson. So I just want to thank her publicly for her very hard work and thank all the stakeholders who engaged over the past 6 or 7 months in this process.
Okay, let's start with Tricia Tillman, Henry Filofsky, and is it Ori Alone? And I know you're going to want to talk about Tobacco 21.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the director of the Public Health Division at Multnomah County Health Department. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of Senate Bill 1559, Tobacco retail licensing is a critical link Oregon communities need to reduce youth access to tobacco and nicotine products, level the playing field for businesses, and enforce our tobacco and nicotine laws. And with 1 in 4 retailers illegally selling to minors, Oregon has the highest illegal sales to minors in the nation. And as you mentioned, 9 out of 10 smokers report starting before age 18, so this is critical. We strongly support efforts to reduce the impact of tobacco and nicotine in our community. This is evidenced by some of our recent policymaking in Multnomah County. Last March, our Board of Commissioners passed an ordinance restricting sales of electronic cigarettes to minors and prohibiting the use of these products in workplaces. Additionally, in November, the board passed our own local ordinance requiring all retailers who sell tobacco and/or nicotine products to pay a fee for the license. Many states and local jurisdictions across the country have implemented local TRL policies. According to the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, as of the first quarter of 2015, only 9 states do not require a tobacco retail license, and Oregon is one of those. Tobacco is the only addictive and potentially deadly product that can be sold without a license. Oregon requires a license to sell many other products, such as prescription drugs, alcohol, lottery, and even a Christmas tree, but not tobacco. We developed our local retail licensing ordinance by engaging community members across the spectrum of geography, race, ethnicity, language, and sectoral and organizational diversity that exists within the county. And if statewide tobacco retail licensing is passed, Multnomah County stands ready to guide and provide input into ensuring engagement of diverse community voices that will help to ensure an equitable public health policy. As was mentioned, tobacco use remains the number one preventable cause of death. Tobacco retail policies that reduce exposure to tobacco products and marketing are components of comprehensive tobacco policies that help reduce tobacco use, which in turn reduces the burden of tobacco use on our healthcare systems. We appreciate your dedication to this very important issue and want to thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony today. And I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Next.
So Chair Monis Anderson and committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Henry Filofsky, and I represent the organization Tobacco 21. With 24% of Oregon's 11th graders currently using tobacco, we are pleased with the attention that this issue has received. We believe that tobacco retail licensure is a strong method of holding retailers accountable for adherence to tobacco sales regulations. However, our organization is firmly against the preemptions listed in the current draft of this bill. Because the tobacco industry is ever more creative in finding ways to get tobacco into the hands of children, we believe it is essential that local governments have the flexibility to react, which would be compromised under the current draft of the bill. That said, my organization's main concern with this bill is that it places the age of sale for tobacco at 18. An analysis published last year looking at the effect of compliance with age 18 laws on youth and their effect on youth smoking found only a small relationship. A major reason for this is that no matter how strictly an age of 18 is enforced, there's still a legal supply of tobacco in high schools because of the senior class. In fact, research done right here in Oregon shows that stricter enforcement of tobacco age regulations at age 18 leads to increased use of social sources of tobacco. Based on research like this, the Institute of Medicine considers social sources of tobacco as one of the primary resources of tobacco to underage smokers. As such, my organization, along with 22 other organizations, recommend that the minimum legal sales age for tobacco in Oregon be raised to 21. 95% of smokers start smoking before the age of 21. And because of this fact, the Institute of Medicine predicts that an age 21 nationwide would reduce smoking initiation among 15 to 17-year-olds by 25%. There are now more than 110 municipalities in the United States with an age 21 for tobacco, including New York City, Boston, and Berkeley, as well as the entire state of Hawaii. In fact, all military branches in Hawaii announced January 1st that they would be voluntarily following the law, Tobacco 21, on military bases, requiring soldiers and sailors to be 21 to buy tobacco in Hawaii. In framing that decision, Rear Admiral John Fuller, who's the commander of the U.S. Navy's Hawaii region and the surface fleet based in Hawaii, said, and I quote, "If someone is young enough to fight for their country, they should be free from addiction to a deadly drug." Thank you for allowing me to speak today, and I can answer any questions you might have at this time.
Chairman Anderson and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak to you today. My name is Ori Lan. I'm a 16-year-old high school student in Portland, and I know that this TRL bill has a sale age of 18. However, I believe it should be at 21. I'm missing class today with the enthusiastic consent of my teachers to speak with you because something must be done about tobacco use in high schools. Here in Oregon, 24% of 11th graders like myself currently use tobacco products. The source of this tobacco is no mystery. At any given time, there is a large number of high school students in the senior class who are legally allowed to buy tobacco products. It's basically become a running joke that on your 18th birthday, you can expect texts from younger students asking you to buy them tobacco. This is why I support raising the age of smoking to 21. If you want to reduce the use of tobacco in high schools, then it is critical that something be done to remove legal access to tobacco from high school social networks. Additionally, with the recent legalization of marijuana for Oregonians at 21 and the longstanding drinking age of 21, students feel like they are being sent mixed signals. Because tobacco is legal at 18, my fellow classmates are getting the message from the government that that tobacco is safer than alcohol or marijuana. That doesn't make sense because tobacco is the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon and nationwide. If you are serious about getting tobacco out of high schools and serious about discouraging teenagers from using tobacco, you should raise the age at which people can buy tobacco to 21. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today, and if you have any questions, I would be happy to try and answer them.
Questions? I want to thank you very much. The more we get our youth involved in this, in the legislative process, the better. So thank you so much for coming. And we've already had two informational hearings, and some are in favor or not of this particular bill. Won't be coming forward, but I want to thank you for coming. All right. With that, let's go with Joshua Nasby. Oh, God, I was way off. Nasby. And Matt Minahan and Morgan Cowling.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Josh Nasby, and I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. The Judicial Department has no position on the underlying policy in this bill, but I did want to talk to you about the procedural issues that prompted the drafting of the Dash 4 amendments. The printed bill in Sections 7 and 8 creates a right of appeal for persons who are adversely affected by licensing and seizure decisions to appeal directly to the Magistrate Division of the Tax Court. And from there, by operation of law, those appeals go to the regular division of the tax court and ultimately to the Oregon Supreme Court. And so I like to think about these courts as our most specialized and rarest judicial resources. Conversely, the decisions that we're talking about in the legislation are, generally speaking, from a legal perspective, mundane decisions. State agencies issue license, deny licenses every day in this state. And so the sort of significant issue that would make it more appropriate to be heard by the tax court or the Supreme Court is absent in most of these cases. For example, if the Department of Revenue were to revoke a license for the repeated sale of cigarettes to a minor, there's no sort of tax court connection. So as Mr. Meyer explained to you earlier, what the Dash 4 does is it says when actions involve tax issues, they go to the tax court. When they don't involve tax issues, they stay under the Administrative Procedures Act with the potential for an appeal to the Court of Appeals. And so that's what the Dash 4, what they do, and I'd be happy to answer any questions about them.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
you.
Nasby.
Good afternoon. Matt Minahan, represent the Northwest Vapor Association. And before I get started, I'd really like to thank everybody on this committee for all the work in the interim to really understand our industry. You know, the amendments from Senator Cruz and Canope, and all the meetings with Senator Hayward speaking at our vape day, and Senator Mona Sanderson, who actually came out and visited me at a vape shop to really see the sampling firsthand and how harmless it is. And Senator Shields, who will be speaking at our vape day next week. So we thank you for that and wish you luck.
I've been there, so you'll survive.
We'll see after today. So the Northwest Vapor Association isn't necessarily opposed to Senate Bill 1559. We just think it's missing an essential, the sampling piece, which is an essential piece to keep our businesses.
So that's the dash five.
That's the dash five. So what that allows us to do is, you know, zero. I mean, we're happy to jump through all the hoops on 1559 to be licensed. We just feel like it's missing the essential piece of our sampling. You know, and what we put in the dash five is we agree not to have any 18 and under or 17 and under in the stores at all. The sampling will contain zero nicotine. We're going to limit our seats, our seating to 10. Then the other two pieces, Mark was a little off on one. So the purpose of the employees to vape is if someone comes in with their vape pen and it's not working, or, you know, the coil's off, instead of walking outside to puff on it to see what's wrong with the device, they can actually test it in the stores. And then, of course, the e-liquid manufacturers who are making the product and testing the new flavors, and again, as opposed to walking outside and testing whether they've got the right mix for the flavor, they'll be able to do that in their own labs. So that's what the Dash 5 does, and, you know, we're total support of the bill with the Dash 5 amendments. Appreciate all your work, and I'm available for questions if you need it.
Thank you. Morgan.
Good afternoon. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Morgan Cowling, and I'm the executive director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, representing the 34 public health departments who work tirelessly to protect the public's health across counties in Oregon. While local health officials support the idea of a strong retail license program in Oregon, I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 1559 as introduced and as written. You know, the Coalition of Local Health Officials does support, and many of our local tobacco prevention and education program and health officials work to enact local tobacco retail licensure programs in our local jurisdictions across Oregon. And we do so for all of the reasons that the senator spoke about and Senator Steiner Hayward spoke about. We know we have a problem with youth access to tobacco products in Oregon, and we need to do something about it. Our SINAR report shows that too many kids who try to purchase tobacco products are able to purchase them. Also listed in our 2015 SINAR report was identified the fact that we don't have up-to-date lists of retailers for tobacco and vape as a challenge to enforcement. So we know that we really need statewide tobacco licensing, and we know it's something that can curb youth access. That said, equally important to those to statewide licensure is allowing local control as a central component to tobacco retail licensure. By restricting or eliminating local control through preemption, innovation and progress on this important topic can be stifled. In Oregon, we are still learning what works best for tobacco retail license, and for this reason, it is essential that we allow local policymakers the flexibility to establish ordinances that are innovative and meet the needs of their communities as a way to better understand best practices in this critical and evolving area. One of the, you know, this, as written, 1559 still includes three preemptions on local cities and counties. It restricts the ability to have your own license, to create ordinances around restrictions in pharmacy and proximity to schools. And we know that, as was just mentioned by one of the young gentlemen earlier, getting access from peers in high school is a way and a gateway to tobacco use. And so a tool to prevent against that would be restricting access so that retailers were not located near schools. And so we're very concerned about these preemptions. And for that reason and those reasons around the preemption, we do have to oppose the bill. That said, we appreciate the chair's hard work on this topic and the Senate supporters. We stand ready if this bill doesn't pass this legislative session. We think that there can be work done on this to compromise, and stand ready to be a part of that work during the interim. We know from our work on the e-cigarette regulation bill, House Bill 2546, we can bring stakeholders together and really get a compromise bill that will protect children and move forward tobacco prevention in the state. Those were my prepared remarks on the bill as introduced. I would say that our work last legislative session on House Bill 2546, we worked really hard to not have a vape shop sampling amendment, and we would also be opposed to that amendment.
Thank you. And I'm sorry that you think that this wasn't a collaborative process, because a lot of what you wanted changed in the bill, we did change. We added education and training as part of the enforcement piece, where some of that funding can be used for that. We took out the citing the exact cost of what a license should be. We did one other thing I can't forget. And you know where my position is. I as a public health nurse, am a purist, as I feel you are a purist. But in the legislative process, I think the greater good is going for a very collaborative approach with the industry as well as with the advocates. So that's what I think this is. Thank you very much. Comments? Okay, Carrie Neeson, Sean Miller,
Or Richard
Kosasan. Richard Kosasan.
Is Carrie here?
Sarah Higginbotham.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association. I was able to testify during the interim days on Senate Bill 1559. It was the LC draft at the time. And so, you know, we did participate, and I appreciate the chair's involvement in the interim to put this looking at a collaborative approach. And so, you know, it is a little disheartening to see some of the opposition from the advocates of statewide licensing addressing the preemption. You know, we are supportive of the bill with the existing preemption in Section 12 and 13 of the bill. I'll explain the changes from the LC draft because they were further refined into the current draft. But, you know, I started last session with an all-out preemption again, advocated for an all-out preemption to provide consistency if we're going to create a license. Multnomah County created their license. There's other jurisdictions that have a license approach. And in talking with those, and even in the Multnomah County process, they said they would much rather have a statewide license. And I do appreciate Multnomah County stepping up and saying that they support the bill, because they were honest in that process and said that if a statewide's in place, they will honor that statewide license process and, again, still participate as a local government. And that's where a lot of the compromise from my end on the industry side came from. Again, I'm you know, they're saying they oppose the bill, and I think their idea of compromise is if they remove the preemption altogether, and that's unacceptable from where we started out in this as a position, which also would have preempted all product restrictions, everything else. All that, everything I heard today, and their concerns is still allowable by a local government on product restrictions, marketing, things that you know, tobacco companies and others may be doing that are getting into the hands of kids that they still would be able to do if this passes. And so, again, that represents a compromise on the industry's part. You know, as for the preemption, it's very limited. It only deals with three parts. If you look on page 4, sections 12 and 13 of the bill, and I'll explain the differences from the LC. All it says is, you know, we're not going to have a statewide license and then have a local license on top of that. Again, statewide can work with the local governments on enforcement, which I fully anticipate them doing. I think that's what Multnomah County has in mind in their process. But there's, you know, having a duplicative license to do the same thing just doesn't make sense. And so, you know, I think that's the first issue. Second issue, one of the differences from the LC-5 is that we were talking about types of businesses, that you couldn't limit types of businesses. In further conversations and opposition during that time, we were willing to, again, compromise again to address on sub 2, lines 19, really down to just pharmacies, which has been a concern, but it was, you know, really limited to not just all types of businesses, but specifically on the pharmacy side. And then sub 3, that was dealing with the location issue, and it was broad in the LC-5, and so again we further compromised down to dealing with the located within a certain distance of a school or real property owned by the city or county, because again, if we are looking at property to develop a new grocery store, you know, saying we're guilty just because we're near park, a school, or some other thing before you know, we can even, you know, build and be able to, you know, not be able to sell the product, I think is defeats the really intent of the bill. And the intent of the bill is to create a licensing program for enforcement to go after the people that are selling to underage people. And that's what we're support. I think that's what the bill does. I think there's been a lot of compromise in this process. And so I just want to make, you know, get that on the record that I think we've come a long way in where we've been. And I guess I'm a little disheartened to hear that the other side hasn't. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Mr. Madam Chair, I will correct some on the other side, because I think there are people that are continuing to support the bill. So.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson, and I serve as the Vice President of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Oregon. I was really conflicted today. I wanted to hit that yes button. I support this, but I instead had to check the no box. In principle, this legislation is all about our kids. It's about putting evidence-based practices into place to discourage the use of tobacco products that can lead to a lifetime addiction and a premature death. In Oregon, every year, 3,300 kids become daily smokers. We can and should do more to prevent our youth from using tobacco. It takes a comprehensive approach to tobacco control policies, and retail licensing is one of these policies. Tobacco remains the number one preventable cause of preventable death and disease in Oregon, and it cost our state $2.4 billion in medical costs and lost productivity. We know that comprehensive tobacco control policies, including retail licensure, help drive down these health costs and have fewer youth use tobacco products. We know the tobacco industry uses retail environments to attract and maintain customers by promoting their brands, increasing the likelihood of impulse product purchases, and establishing the presence of tobacco products as commonplace. I guess I'm one of those other people on the other side of this argument. I'm very troubled by the preemption pieces in the legislation. I can sort of understand, one, I can understand where we wouldn't want to have additional retail licenses at the local level. I'm very troubled by the fact that communities couldn't have tobacco-free pharmacies in their communities. I think it's important that when you have pharmacies that should be promoting health, I think it makes good sense that they're not selling a product when used as intended kills. I'm also deeply disturbed that local communities couldn't set boundaries for distances from school children. This last weekend, I had the good fortune of being in Cottage Grove and met with a very active, engaged youth advocacy group. And they had worked with their city council and worked to establish tobacco-free parks And we're also in the middle of working with the city council to adopt an ordinance on retail licensure. And these kids are impassioned and are trying to figure out ways to keep their friends off tobacco and discourage those who are smoking to get off tobacco. And I just, you know, I just want to empower those kids, and I want to empower communities to do what they need to do to solve their problems. So I really hope, I would love to take my no box and make that into a yes, and I think removing some of these preemption clauses so communities can do what needs to be done and what works for them is in the best interest.
Just as a point of reference, as a public health nurse working for Clackamas County, we had a lot more money to use in the tobacco prevention program, and that's where the real work is, not necessarily where the placement of the tobacco product was. And we had one of the very low use by youth when we really had a very strong tobacco prevention program. So I will beg to differ a little bit that location is the only way we can get youth from not using it. I'm saying a very strong tobacco prevention program with education, training, and in the schools is far more effective. My point of view can't really, anyway, yes.
Do you want Mr. Costa's hand to speak first, or do you want me to
go ahead?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I find myself in a sort of awkward position here, but I want to go back to what I said at the beginning of the hearing, Ms. Neeson. We are long overdue to pass tobacco retail licensure in the state. It embarrasses me beyond words that Oregon's one of a handful of states that doesn't require this licensure and therefore does not have the enforcement tools. That being said, I have long been an advocate for not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I guess, despite the fact that the most populous county in the state, Multnomah County, did pass a retail licensure bill and other jurisdictions have, I'm not at all convinced that two of the next most populous states, the counties, Marion, Polk, Washington, Clackamas, are at all likely to pass them. And I'm also not convinced that some of our more rural communities will be inclined to do that. And frankly, I don't see why certain kids should be protected and other kids shouldn't by this. And I agree with Mr. Miller, and I've talked with Mr. Mayer about this. There is nothing in these preemptions that says anything about how those things can be displayed, about where they have to be located in the store, about hours where they can be sold, about exactly which types of products can be sold. All of those things are left to the discretion of the local jurisdiction, which strikes me as a pretty broad opening for a lot of jurisdictions to go through. You're right. I'd much prefer to keep these away from schools, but in a lot of communities, that's not even possible, right? It's absolutely not possible. And we know that complete prohibition doesn't work, right? We learned that with alcohol in the 20s. So I guess my question to you is it better to wait 1, 2, 3, 4 more years to pass a statewide bill to protect all of Oregon's children on the hope that we can get one without any preemption? Or is it better to get this done now and live to come back another day and try to protect more kids now? I mean, to some extent, that's a rhetorical question, I hope. But I want to add one other thing before you answer. As far as I know, Oregon is one of the only states that's including shops that sell inhalant delivery systems in their licensure law. And that's a huge step in the right direction. Because if we don't include them, then we're going to transfer this problem over to inhalant delivery systems. And the industry there has been very helpful. They supported our adding those to the Indoor Clean Air Act last year. They supported our making the sale of age over 18. And they have not said expressed any significant concerns and have participated in the process around this licensure, which says a lot for their desire to protect kids and keep these things out. I'm just struggling a lot. I've had a lot of conversations with people over the past several days about this. Of course, I'd prefer there be no preemption. But what I really want is to take some major steps in the right direction. And I guess I need to understand
how the Lung Association and others deal with that problem that I'm addressed, that I'm pointing out.
I guess I'm forever an optimist, and I have to advocate on behalf of lung health. And our mission is to save lives by improving lung health and preventing lung disease. So I would say, why not go for an excellent policy and not settle for good? I don't have all those answers. You have a tough job up there. But I would love to see something that's most protective for our youth.
Okay. I mean, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I would say is I'd like to protect as many kids as possible as soon as possible. And I'll take that over a perfect policy. I agree. I'd like to have as good a policy as absolutely possible. I think that the grocers have come an awful long way. I think the tobacco industry has come a long way. The vaping industry has come a long way on this. We've given up some stuff. They've given up a bunch of stuff. And frankly, this is a pretty strong law. It's not perfect, but it's pretty darn good. So that's why I'm prepared to say yes to this.
Richard.
Chair Monis Anderson, thank you. For some strange reason, I feel a little bit outnumbered this afternoon. I represent the Oregon Neighborhood Store Association, which basically was started approximately 20 years ago to represent the interests of the smaller grocery store, predominantly convenience store orientation. As drafted, we would oppose Senate Bill 1559. I handed out to the committee existing tobacco-related regulations regarding statutory provisions, all associated with, quote, the regulation of tobacco in the state. And these are longstanding. But I think the first issue is, before we go down the path of additional regulation, we should take a look at the first question, and that is the enforcement of existing laws, the problems associated with the enforcement of existing laws, and how do we improve that? Coupled with these, I think you are aware in 2009 the Tobacco Control Act was passed, signed by President Obama. And that did a number of things, but in recent months, the most important thing I think it did, with their inspection program throughout all of the states, if an individual is found in violation of sales of certain products to minors, the FDA now maintains the ability to go in and issue a stop sales order. Complete prohibition on that retailer from selling product, which I don't have a problem with. If a problem retailer is continuing to be nonchalant about the sales of tobacco to minors, and they do indeed sell such product to minors, they probably should not be in that business. Specifically with respect to Senate Bill 1559, however, I would say there's some good parts and some not so good parts. In terms of the registration system through the Department of Revenue, I think that's a very strong positive step forward. On a uniform and statewide basis, we would not have a problem with that. Through the OLCC and through the Department of Revenue, I think a lot of that information is available today. So for certain individuals to suggest that we don't have that information, I don't think is an accurate picture. Some concerns with the bill, Section 5 in terms of the licensure, there is no limitation on the fee. The department administering Sections 1 to 11 of this act, basically they can set a fee, and that fee could be $50, $250, $1,500, or $2,500. For small retailers with a sound record of no sales to minors, a high fee, I think, is basically a penalty. And I don't think we should set a situation like that. In terms of discipline, I think it's a step in the right direction, but I think as drafted currently, that is a little bit too broad. Section 7, the Department of Revenue may revoke, suspend, or refuse to issue or renew a license. So, one, an inadvertent sale to a minor. Under this, the way it is correctly drafted, that individual, that retailer, could lose their license. That I think that is just a little bit excessive. Again, Section 10, Department of Revenue shall adopt rules necessary for the effective administration of the Act. I think there should be some sideboards, if possible, to be incorporated with that section. I like Section 11, but I think it should look at further clarification between the coordination between FDA and their inspection program, their regulations, health authority, the health authority's administration of the SINAR amendment. And the SINAR amendment has been around since 1992, basically saying that states are going to have laws on the books that you're not going to sell any tobacco products to minors. You're going to enforce such laws, and you're going to make inspections of retailers, and you're going to report back to the federal government. So I think that could be strengthened. But as currently drafted, with all due respect, we would oppose the bill. Thank you.
Question. Thank you, panel, very much for coming. And the last two that are on our list are Sarah Higginbotham and Luis Rodriguez.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Sarah Higginbotham. I'm here on behalf of the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. First and foremost, thank you for your time today, considering Oregon's number one preventable cause of death, keyword preventable. And thank you for your work on this bill and attention to it. You've already heard about the problem of youth tobacco use. You've already heard that 24% of kids report that they're using. So I'll just highlight a few points around the bill. And since some folks have already shared opinions that we share, what I will do is just add a few quick notes about why it is some of the public health organizations and why the American Heart Association has some qualms with the bill as is. Number one, we're lagging behind on tobacco retail licensure, so we're excited that this issue has come up again, that this bill is here, and that you've been championing it. We are supportive of a tobacco retail licensure program that includes an effective fee that's going to cover enforcement and education, and most importantly, education that's culturally and linguistically appropriate. Our concerns are around the preemption. I just wanted to highlight one key part that I'm not sure has been brought up, and you all know it, and I think you have very tough decisions to make, but I think it's important to also explain why we're so strong on this issue of protecting, not taking out toolboxes out of the tobacco control toolbox. So just a note, local control, since it's been 50 years since the Surgeon General first released their report about the dangers of tobacco, and in that time, local control has proven absolutely integral to tobacco control policies that have emerged at the local level, often after long and hard-fought grassroots efforts. These efforts increase local awareness of tobacco control issues, they build community readiness and support, and they foster public debate around the need for policy change and healthy social norms. So there is incredible value in the work that happens around local policies. And I'll just touch on the two policies in particular that are in here that would be taken out of the toolbox. One is the ban on tobacco sales in healthcare institutions, and specifically pharmacies. 2008, San Francisco became the first city to ban sales of tobacco in pharmacies, followed closely after by Boston, Massachusetts. Shortly thereafter, around the state of Massachusetts, 108 communities, municipalities in Massachusetts followed suit. The second policy, limiting the density of tobacco retailers or the distance of retailers around schools. There is limited research in the area that suggests the presence of tobacco retailers near schools may influence adolescent tobacco use by making cigarettes easier to provide. And of course, we know that tobacco advertising on the external part of those retailers increases the odds of trying smoking, advertising in general, I should say. My point in mentioning these facts is just that we do believe that these policies deserve their own consideration and time to be examined on their own merits before we remove them out of that toolbox. That said, we appreciate the hard decision before you, and we appreciate the time that you're spending on it. Thank you for allowing me to explain a little bit about why we approach this issue the way we do. And finally, thank you so much to the chair and to Senator Steiner Hayward for their support of Tobacco 21, a policy that would raise the legal sale age of tobacco. We realize that's not something that we'll be able to do in this bill, but we wanted to bring it up here because it is part of that point of sale conversation and a huge part of access. And so we look forward to moving forward with that conversation in the next year. Thank you.
Thank you. Louis, thank you for coming.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Luis Rodriguez. I'm the Government Relations Director for the State of Oregon with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. The advocates prior to me have done an eloquent job of laying out some of the reasons why a tobacco retail licensure program is important to tobacco control policy in Oregon, as well as some of the reasons why we should rethink this preemption in Section 13. ACS CAN does not support preemption. Especially around the retail location and retail type around the pharmacies. And the reason is that we often find innovation in tobacco control happening at the local level. As you know, Sarah mentioned here just a moment ago, a lot of these policies sort of bubble up from cities and counties, and then we start to look at them, we build a base of evidence, we start to see if they're effective or not. And we mobilize communities around these issues. And so we have to get out of the habit of preempting cities and counties from taking on these tasks and from addressing the burden of tobacco use within their communities in innovative ways. So we are against the preemption, but I certainly want to thank you for all of your work on this and thank you for hearing our concerns on the preemption. And then I also wanted to thank you for your support on the Tobacco 21 issue. We have 40 advocates in the building today from all across the state. Some of them might be joining us in the blue shirts in this hearing room who are advocating for raising the legal age of sale for tobacco products to 21. And we're really excited, kicking off a two-day advocacy effort with the American Heart Association. So we'll have about 150 advocates today and tomorrow doing legislative meetings and talking about the importance of this issue. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, and thank you again for allowing me to share that.
Okay, any other comments? All right. With that, we will be rolling this bill over to next. Let's roll it over till Thursday. I'm not sure we can address it Thursday. I need to talk to all of the members of this committee. We need to talk
to
our
session only.
For work session only, yeah. So we have our homework to do. So with that, thank you, everyone, for coming. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1559, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1504. Bring us up to date, Sandy, on what this bill does.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you'll recall that we had a couple of informationals during the interim legislative days on the Physical Therapy Licensure Compact, which I think everybody is briefed on. It's a voluntary arrangement between two or more states that is designed to solve a problem that becomes part of each state's laws. At this time, there are no amendments. We do have a fiscal and a revenue impact on the bill, which is a no revenue and just a minimal impact on the original bill.
Okay. I'd like to call Joanna Tucker Davis and Kyle Martin up. Colleagues, I was ready to pass this out, and then the Department of Justice let us know that this is unconstitutional. So,
that's a minor issue.
So, I would like DOJ to explain why this is unconstitutional, and I have a couple questions. And
sure. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Martin, and I have with me today Joanna Tucker Davis. We're Assistant Attorneys General with the Department of Justice, and we're here on behalf of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice has a neutral position on the bill, but does have some serious legal concerns about it with regard to constitutionality. And Joanna has submitted some written testimony today, and she is most familiar, so I'm going to kind of turn it over to her to go over the legal issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Joanna Tucker Davis. My concerns, constitutional concerns, are two. First, what happens in this is the compact forms a commission, of which Oregon would be one voting state. Oregon would be obliged to pay assessments that are levied by this commission, which aren't capped in this, which is the concern we'll talk about next. Oregon is obliged to enforce the rules of this commission as if they're statutory law, and Oregon is agreeing to be sued in federal court if it does not comply with the provisions of this compact. So the question is, there is, under the Constitution, a provision that says the legislature may not create liabilities that exceed the sum of $50,000. This is known as the pay-as-you-go provision in the Constitution, the idea being that a current legislature shouldn't create a bill that will be due to a future legislature. There are exceptions in the Constitution to this. Those don't apply here. The Oregon Supreme Court has articulated sort of a two-part test about if this is triggered. The first part, is there a special designated fund for paying the money? There is not that here. The second part is the future legislature obliged to pay the liability or debt? And it would be under this compact. So there's various ways this could be alleviated, and DOJ wouldn't have an opinion about which of those ways would be best. That would be a policy call, obviously, for the legislature. But one is, it could be capped at below $50,000, and that would not trigger this constitutional provision. It could be contingent on some other event, like licensing fees collected under this provision, or contingent on approval of either the board or the legislature approving whether it will pay this money in the future. The other issue is that there's a series of cases in which the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals talk about what's called unconstitutional delegation of authority. And it's based actually on three separate provisions in the Constitution. And the general idea of this is that the Oregon government shouldn't be giving away its prospective lawmaking authority to an entity that it doesn't control. That Oregon government should be responsible for its laws and its provisions. It's based on the idea of government accountability and that the protection of citizens from arbitrary actions. And here the issue is that the compact actually delegates to this commission rulemaking authority, and Oregon must enforce these rules as if they're Oregon law. In fact, they talk about the judicial, executive, and legislative branch enforcing those rules. So the question here is the issue of Oregon giving away its rulemaking authority, its ability to make laws, to this commission, which isn't under Oregon's control. This could be alleviated by having either the board or the legislature ratify those rules, instead of just saying, basically, prospectively, whatever those rules are, we must then enforce as if they're our statutes or our rules. There's also a practical concern in that the compact creates conflicts with other statutes that need to be addressed in conforming amendments. Those provisions that would need to be harmonized so that there's not a direct conflict include the Administrative Procedures Act, the Public Records and Meetings Law, provisions that govern current licensure of physical therapists, and the statutes that govern confidentiality of investigative records. Investigative records must be given to the commission and shared with other states. Currently, in ORS 676, 175, and 177, those are only allowed to be disclosed to certain people. So that's just one example of the need for conforming amendments. And thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Cruz.
So your concern is the structure of this compact, not compacts in general.
Yes. So
okay.
Section
because
seven.
We have compacts.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. This compact is designed basically to be a fair trade across borders sort of thing. So what you're saying is, if this was structured similar to some of the other compacts that we are members of, then you wouldn't have a problem with it.
Yes. So I have not looked at those other compacts. My specific concerns are in Section 7 and 10 of this compact.
Okay.
Okay. So I've been informed that we have adopted more than 20 compacts in this state.
Oh, yeah. We've been part
and,
of it.
Yeah, I know we have. And so there's a compact for adult offender supervision in ORS 144.6, and it contains the same provisions you just cited, the concerns that you have. So I'm wondering how this compact is not constitutional, yet we've been working with the other with the same type of language. So that's my concern regarding the way the wording is here.
So, Chair Monis Anderson, I have not looked at that compact. I have not done an analysis side by side, looked at the context of that, so I would not be able to talk to that other compact.
So what I would recommend, and I've talked with Suzanne Trujillo in Legislative Council, that it's most important. To me, I'm looking at the goal. The goal is definitely not to be unconstitutional. The goal is to provide care, access to Oregonians from a physical therapy who has their license in another state. Mm-hmm. It's reciprocity. It's how I've done my, I got my nursing degree in the state of Virginia, and thank goodness for reciprocity. We don't have compacts, we have reciprocity, so I was able to practice here in the state of Oregon. So the goal, that's the goal, and I'm hoping that you and Suzanne Trujillo can come together to see somehow if we could save this bill. I hear that you're a little bit worried that maybe we can't, but I sure would like that to happen.
So, Chair Monis Anderson, I'm happy to provide whatever technical assistance I can. I obviously can't provide input on, for example, what choices are made to alleviate these concerns.
I'm going to make it constitutional.
Yes. Yeah.
You're not fun.
And Chair Monis Anderson, this is Kyle Martin. Of course, we will try to work with her, but the time frame is rather short, and we're just not sure of all the different people involved that would need to be involved in this, as well as what sort of structure is necessary from the sponsors of the compact. So, I mean, the time frame is quite short from our standpoint.
Well, with the other compacts, I don't think the threshold of 50,000 has ever been reached, and so I don't know. Inga, do you have any comments to make at this point on this? And then we're going to just
if we need to put a hard line in there, and that takes care of it, then we can put a hard line in there.
Maybe. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Inga Deckert on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association. I will say this is an unexpected development late in the game, and so we're still trying to look at the questions and the concerns that have been raised. I would like to reiterate for the record something that the chair just mentioned, that the state has adopted 20-plus compacts. Now, they are structured somewhat differently, but there are some that are structured in very much the same way as the PT licensure compact that you have before you today. And one of those that was just mentioned, the Adult Offender Supervision Compact, I have looked at the language, and it does contain language that is either identical or very similar to language that's in the PT compact. It doesn't have, for example, a limit on the fees, and it does allow that commission to promulgate rules that have the effect of law. And so, I'm having a difficult time understanding why those compacts have been adopted with no questions asked or raised either by Legislative Council or the Department of Justice at the time, and suddenly this one, which looks the same if not similar, these questions are being raised.
Okay. Yeah, and Chair Monis Anderson, I don't know if you're looking for a response, but I mean, we can't respond to that from the standpoint we don't know. Yeah. But
we have an attorney here. Attorneys here. Attorneys in LC. Mm-hmm. Get them together and look what happened. Okay.
You get three attorneys and you have four opinions. That's basically the way it is.
So I really appreciate your input and welcome to us. I know you started in January. Is that?
Well, here? I started actually with the Department of Justice in 2007.
Okay.
Yes. But the physical therapy board is new. It's a recently reassigned board to me. Yes.
But anyway, nice to meet you, and glad you are here. And what we're going to do is we're just going to talk with our Legislative Council. Hopefully they'll talk to you, see if – I know you say it's a short time frame, but I'm hoping that we can salvage this bill.
That would be nice.
With that, thank you very much. Comments? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1504, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1503. We really don't need much. Is anyone sign up for this?
We're getting it right now. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1503 removes the January 1, 2018 sunset date, making the requirement that an insurer reimburse licensed physician assistants and certified nurse practitioners for primary care services at the same rate as a licensed physician for the same services. There is no revenue impact. There is no fiscal impact. You have a dash one amendment before you that was collaboratively drafted by the Nurses Association and the Medical Board, and it places a reporting requirement on the reimbursement amounts. DCBS will do one data collection, and they will report that back to the Legislative Assembly no later than January 31st, 2017.
Okay, Jen Baker, Madeline Simmons, Elizabeth Remley.
Did you call Elise Brown? Did you see her? Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, my name is Jen Baker, here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. I will be very brief. We're here enthusiastically supporting Senate Bill 1503, which would remove the sunset on Oregon's payment parity law. Oregon's payment parity law is helping to retain and grow an important workforce of primary and mental health providers in our throughout our state, and I will leave that discussion to Madeline here, who's an NPO member. But I do want to just remind you that as part of the 2013 discussion around this legislation, we had a task force, the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. That task force has since concluded its work and reported back to this body twice and made no specific recommendations as to Oregon's payment parity law. They did, however, encourage the legislature to continue to explore more ways to create additional primary care and mental health provider capacity in Oregon and pursue alternative payment models for the entire healthcare system. That is a mission that ONA and NPO full-heartedly support. And as such, we are, and in the spirit of collaboration, in support of the Dash One amendment that Sandy has described for you. We are also to put on the record supporting an amendment at the request of Cambia Health Solutions and others that would to be adopted in the next chamber that would outline that the data collection is one time only and that would make a quick correction to the term clinic number, which is within the amendment, and replace that with clinic identifier, and that is just to make sure that the language that we're using in this legislation is consistent with the language that the insurance companies are using. So with that, I will turn it over to Madeline.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. I'm Madeline Simmons. I'm a psych nurse practitioner in Bend, Oregon. I've been in practice for 9 years, and I serve clients both in an office in Bend and one in Redmond, Oregon. I come to strongly support removing of the sunset clause from the Oregon Nurse Practitioner Parity Law. I spoke with you when you were originally considering the bill in 2013 and have included some of that testimony should you want to go back to it. I want to focus today on the benefits of parity and what is happened since parity in my practice and what I know of what's going on in Central Oregon. Parity encourages small businesses and makes it easier for practitioners to run viable businesses. With parity, I've been able to manage the costs of changing billing systems, changing billing codes, changing diagnostic codes, and moving up so I can prescribe controlled substances electronically. I've grown my business enough to hire some part-time help, and therefore hiring people, and also making it so I can focus more on client care. So with the parity, I've been able to take that small bump up to become more efficient and hire some more folks and serve more clients. Parity also makes it easier for nurse practitioners and other folks to enter the field. just recently, one of my former nursing students left her nurse practitioner position at the county to open a small business. We were able to send her a ton of referrals, get her practice up and going, and she was able to take that jump from working to somebody to actually running her own small business rather seamlessly because of parity. Her position, interestingly, at the county was filled by, unfortunately for you guys, a psychiatrist from Salem. So for Central Oregon, we're like one up as far as mental health providers, and we'll take all we can get. In Central Oregon, we have a tremendous need for psychiatric providers. My practice has been filled for a number of years, and there's still a tremendous number of people calling, desperate to get care for loved ones and kids. So it's not like there's giant competition for clients out there. We don't have the numbers to provide care for all the people who need it. This summer, we lost a psychiatrist suddenly, and it was a real scramble to divide her caseload up among both the nurse practitioners and psychiatrists in town. Parity has made it possible for nurse practitioners and psychiatric nurse practitioners in particular to serve Medicare clients. Medicare reimbursement rates, as you guys know, are not really high in this state. And parity has made it possible for nurse practitioners to take Medicare clients while maintaining a viable business. Mm-hmm. This, again, helps the small businesses stay afloat and provide care for Oregonians. Parity also increases incentives to take on difficult clients. There's a point beyond which you only do so much work if you're not reimbursed for it. And it's possible with the tremendous need out there to absolutely cherry pick and take the easy, pleasant clients, have a full caseload, and call it good. I think that we need to be encouraging people to really dig in and take as many complicated people as they're willing to take. And parity does help in that regard. Let's see. Parity's made it possible to attend a bit more continuing education for me. And That's given time to collaborate with a variety of mental health providers. Let's see. I think I'll just close by saying that nurse practitioner parity has helped ease some of the discrimination between genders in healthcare in Oregon. Many of the people who are nurse practitioners now are working at the top of their license, and while there are equal representations of genders in perhaps nursing school and medical school at this point, that hasn't always been the case. So for providers who are working at the top of their license and have been working in the field for decades, parity is a way to perhaps even out some of the discrimination that used to happen and we're hoping to address. I'm happy to take questions if you have any, and thank you for your work on behalf of mental health care in Oregon.
Well, thank you for coming all the way from Bend, Redmond.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, I'm Elizabeth Remley here today representing the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. We support Senate Bill 1503, and we appreciate the Nurses Association taking the lead on working to propose this bill. There isn't much I can say that hasn't been said by Ms. Simmons and Jen, so I urge your support. You have my written testimony. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Good job. All right. Elise Brown, David Walls, and Courtney Dresser.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. I'm here today and appreciate the opportunity to offer some feedback on Senate Bill 1503. You heard from carriers, or at least a carrier representative during the January legislative days, that we remain in opposition to removing the sunset, so opposition to the bill. We still see an opportunity for the stakeholders around the table to continue the discussion till the sunset date of 2018. So you see one of AHIP's members, Providence, submitted some written testimony to that effect. Outreach today, though, with the chair and members of ONA and OMA have led to some friendly discussion that we hope to continue over on the House side, and that's why I'm here for the record to state that. ONA just listed a couple of the ideas that we had, again, technical fixes to their Dash 1 amendment. Sunsetting Section 3 as it's a one-time data collection. A term clinic number is not a word that we use as carriers in processing claims, so we wanted to substitute that. And the last and one that she hasn't mentioned was also adding a data request to the Oregon Board of Nursing and the OMA Board that ask how many new independent nurse practitioner physician assistant practices have opened since the law passed. As you recall, the goal of this was one of the objectives was to expand access to primary care services. So we think that that data is equally important to have going forward in this discussion. So again, here to say that with the opportunity to make these corrections over in the House, I feel that we can bring our AHIP carrier members to a neutral point and I'll be there together. So thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, my name is David Walls, Executive Director with the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. We represent over 1,200 osteopathic physicians, students, and residents in the state of Oregon. Thanks for the opportunity to provide comments on Senate Bill 1503. If we remove the sunset in Senate Bill 1503, we make a permanent policy that standardizes payments across practitioners that have different educational, credentialing, insurance, and certification requirements. It's discouraging when I hear this bill referred to as the pay parity bill. And I want to be really clear that OPSO does not oppose equal pay for equal work. And I want to be really clear that OPSO strongly supports increasing reimbursement in primary care, increasing reimbursement for nurse practitioners in primary care, and increasing reimbursement for nurse practitioner or physician assistants in primary care. All the benefits that the nurse practitioner in Central Oregon discussed, We support increasing that reimbursement, but it can be done without a standardized payment. And pay parity is really a misnomer because the system set up is not, the billing code environment that we're working in is not one that is set up to be paid on a work value. It is paid on costs. And I'm certainly not a billing expert, but as I understand the reimbursement billing codes right now, they're set up on cost components, and those cost components include professional liability insurance, they include the overhead, basically the practice costs, and they include the work and time and skill of the practitioner that's providing those services. So we're in a service that's set up not on what value is created, but what those costs are. And in a system, reimbursement system that's based on costs, when we're standardizing payments, we're ignoring the additional costs of training of a physician as compared to a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. So the additional costs being borne by physicians who have increased medical school tuition, increased certification and residency programs, that's a significant cost. And again, pay parity, we're talking about payment for that work. By standardized payments in the current payment model, the bill essentially says there's no value in physicians having that residency training and the clinical training. But I really hope we aren't focusing on this comparison. What I really want to get to is the heart of what I think HB 2902 should have been, and that is creating policies that increase primary care payment, not worrying about trying to standardize payments, but really increasing primary care. I've always considered 2902 to be a primary care workforce bill. As I stated in testimony in January when I spoke, the defined problem was not the difference in the payments between provider types, but it was the fact that insurers were dropping payments to nurse practitioners. 2902 specifically called for the development of a comprehensive payment structure across all provider types, and it was to promote the maintenance and expansion of primary care across all workforce providers. So I want to continue that work. The current language in 2902, the payment model does not expire until 2018. So we have the full 2016 interim and the full 2017 to explore opportunities to increase primary care, but not necessarily tie those payments together. And I'd be happy to take any questions.
Courtney Dresser for the Oregon Medical Association, and you've heard testimony from us on this issue for many, many years. But I did want to just state that although OMA is opposed to the bill that we're looking at today, we do want to thank both the ONA and the chair for allowing us to work on an amendment. We think the data collection in the dash one and possibly another dash on the House side is going to be beneficial to all parties and to the legislative body as we continue to keep battling this issue, and again, not the issue of payment parity, but the issue of workforce development in our rural states and rural part of our state and alternative payment models altogether. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Everything I want to say about this concept I said 2 years, 3 years ago, I'm not going to say it again. We need to continue to develop alternative payment methodologies, and I would encourage this conversation to include the work we did on Senate Bill 632. Which looked at the percentage of insurance premiums that were going toward primary care specialties. We should be getting those data from OHA shortly, and that needs to be part of this conversation as well. I hope to hear also from OHA when they come to report to us on that on those data that the collaborative that we specified in that bill has been making some progress towards alternative payment methodologies. Once we deal with that, this will largely become a moot point, as it should be. Until that time, we need to keep moving forward because nurse practitioners are providing critical services in areas that are underserved in our state. So what I really hope is that we stop paying fee-for-service, especially in primary care and mental health. Bottom line. I just got to get that on the record, and I apologize. I'm going to have to leave because I have a conference call.
What? Any other questions?
No.
Are you ready to vote?
Anybody vote? Okay. Good.
Okay. Well, I'll close the – thank you. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1503 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1503.
I move the dash one amendment into Senate Bill 1503.
Senator Cruz moves to adopt the dash one amendment.
Just wanted to comment.
Conflict. Yes. Dash one amendments into Senate Bill 1503.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in abundance of caution, even though my wife is part of a larger class and therefore technically not subject to the requirement of conflict of interest, I did want to put on the record in an abundance of caution that my spouse is a nurse practitioner that will be affected by this bill.
Okay. Is there any opposition to the adoption of the dash one amendments? It is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1503 as amended by the dash one amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 1503 as adopted with the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any more discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Hello?
Aye.
Senator
Shields? Aye.
Senator Snyder-Hayward?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz will carry the bill.
Yes, and Madam Chair, I want to make sure that in the carry that I specifically reference the points that need to be made in the amendment on the House side so it's clearly on the record.
Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1503 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1505. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1505 authorizes the Department of Consumer and Business Services to adopt by rule fees that are reasonably calculated to pay costs associated with administering laws regulating pharmacy benefit managers. It provides DCBS with the authority to enforce the laws regulating the PBMs and requires PBMs to reimburse network pharmacies for drugs at the rate that is not less than the price of the drug specified in most recently updated maximum allowable costs for drugs, updates and clarifies laws regulating pharmacy benefit managers. You have a dash one amendment that deletes in the original bill the $50 registration fee and allows DCBS to adopt reasonable fees under their authority. also allows DCBS to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew a PBM registration, and adds a way to condition a registration, and it also allows DCBS to recover investigation expenses. We have a fiscal statement on the dash one and a no revenue statement on the dash one.
Okay, Kevin Russell, Bill Cross, and Rick Blackwell, and I guess Jeanette Taylor, too, but just, okay.
I was just going to introduce, so.
You don't have to, Bill.
Yeah, no, okay.
I really have to leave a word out
there. Yeah, okay. And we want to devote 20 minutes to this, so. So we'll start with Kevin Russell.
Hi, welcome. Thank you. So I represent, I'm Kevin Russell. I'm president-elect of Oregon State Pharmacy Association. And also represent the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. I'm testifying today in support of 1505 with the dash one amendment. And I do want to recognize that the dash one, with the dash one amendment, this does actually give up some important pieces of regulatory relief, which pharmacies need, basically from unfair reimbursement practices in the PBMs. It does eliminate, it doesn't address properly, I think, the transparency and standardization of the MAC pricing and how that's determined. It doesn't address timing and notification of MAC pricing changes. And then when a MAC appeal is granted and approved by a PBM, the amended bill does not address to which claims the reimbursement must apply. But having all those things, said all those things, we are in support of the bill as amended, because it does some important things, and that is that it provides the Department of Consumer and Business Services mechanisms of enforcement in cases where violation of current regulations occur. And it provides a simple thing, but very important to us, which we don't always have, which is a phone number and a contact with the PBMs, with an individual who can actually address an appeal for a claim. And it provides some reasonable guidelines and regarding audits and mechanisms for appeal for audits. So these provisions provide a very positive step forward in resolving these claims. And we're willing to concede the other pieces for now and support the bill as amended. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm the manager of policy and actuarial services in the Division of Financial Regulation. This is the new division that includes the former insurance division. I want to be clear, we are actually neutral on the bill. We can't express an opinion either way without the governor's permission. But we have provided input on request, and if it's the policy directive of the legislature to have us step up enforcement of the PBM statutes, then we're certainly willing to try to work through those issues. So that's really the lens for which we've been acting on the bill. To be super brief, pharmacy benefit managers are third-party providers. They work for insurers to process claims, pay pharmacies, and negotiate rebates with drug manufacturers. The original bill had basically a registration requirement, pay a fee of $50, you're on a list. That's really the extent of DCBS's current enforcement or any sort of authority over PBMs at this point. Most of the complaints that we've had so far have run through the advocacy process, so we have an established system of consumer advocates that try to work out how to help consumers have issues with their insurers. But we did have a large, I suppose, tranche of complaints of alleged conduct from an entity that actually represents pharmacies. So we went back and looked through the volume of complaints. About 33% are actually Medicare Part D, which we would have no authority over the bill, or over no matter what the bill looks like.
You said 30?
33% of the line item allegations of the complaints, yeah. Most of the allegations we've seen involve not responding within a specified timeline, not having the telephone number available to discuss an appeal, not providing what's called the National Drug Code, and since I've been here for a month, I'm not entirely sure what that is, but I can certainly turn to my colleague if possible. And then if an appeal is denied, not providing an alternative national drug code. So these are really the issues that we've seen in the line item type of complaints. We've engaged with pharmacy benefit managers to try to help informally, voluntarily resolve the issues, and we have had some success to a degree. PBMs have taken some complaints seriously about how to contact, how to make that connection between the pharmacies and the PBMs. So really, we're just here to provide a little bit of background for where we're at, and we can answer any questions on the bill.
So there were 26,000 complaints, and one-third of those were Medicare?
Yes. So, Chair Montes-Anderson, to go back, there's a, we've had complaints regarding 22 entities, but within those complaints, then we would have a line item, which is, well, on this, you know, this alleged violation occurred in so many instances. So they added up to about 23,000 line item instances. Again, within there, from what has been reported to us, and you know, this is information submitted voluntarily by the PBMs, we understand about 33% of those are would be preempted by federal law.
Okay. Yeah. And in order to follow up with those particular complaints, I know that we want to give you enforcement capability. And would do you see a need to be able to, well, the terms are use condition, suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew registration of a pharmacy benefit manager. I know that's contentious regarding suspend and revoke. Those two words in particular, and I was just curious where, what tools is normal, I guess, for the insurance.
Sure. Well, let me step back and say that enforcement is really about, I mean, we view enforcement as compliance. We really would rather that people just follow the law. Sometimes, for the most part, having the leverage available, we can usually have a reasonable, cordial discussion about how compliance can be achieved. Sometimes there's parties that where we just can't find cooperation, and that's where those tools would come into play. So I would like to at least say that compliance is this kind of tools would be a later resort for us. We'd rather not have to use them.
And maybe yeah. It's too early to say, but out of those 23,000 complaints,
yeah.
Do any of them even come close to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew?
I mean, off the top of my head, I couldn't really answer that, but we could certainly come back and answer that for you if you like. Yeah.
I guess I just sort of want to, that some of these complaints, I think, would never rise to that level, and maybe you just can't say that.
Right. I should add that there's some confidentiality statutes at play, and so I don't want to give away too much.
All right. All right. That's fine.
Thank you.
And we're looking at deleting Section 4. And that provides you the ability to inquire about the activities of a pharmacy benefit manager and about any matter connected to the transactions. And that particular section, where
Section 4 actually mirrors the data call and the exam authority that's already in the insurance code in ORS in 731-296. The issue is with that statute is that it may not cover a PBM, which is technically a registrant.
And so that's why this would
that's correct.
Be
that would be the, that would be that. My sense that's why it's there. Okay. So.
And then lastly, regarding the definition of pharmacy, I guess that doesn't, never mind. Okay, that I'll want PBMs
sure.
to address.
Sure.
So could you stay in
yes,
the room?
Of course. Thank you.
Do you have any questions? All right, so
did
let's.
You, did you want anything from Jeanette?
Jeanette, do you need?
Sure.
Yes.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So you said the complaints came from where?
The bulk of the complaints are, and again, I have to be careful how much information I give, but there's an entity that represents particular the other entities, pharmacies that have put out the complaints. Yeah.
And that came from out of state?
I'm not sure that I can disclose that.
I think you already did, but okay.
Okay.
And Jeanette, did you want?
Just here for backup.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I'd like to call Jonathan Eames, Elise Brown, and Elizabeth Remley.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee now. This is always happens when I testify if people leave the room. It's just my luck. For the record, I'm Jonathan Eames. I am here on behalf of CVS Health, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. The Dash 1 amendments, which is what we're talking about today, we've had conversations with every member of the committee as well, expressing our concerns. We have been working with you, Senator, on trying to find a way where we can give the department the authority, or the agency the authority, to be able to enforce the law, because the last thing that we want to do is not follow the law, and we absolutely believe that PBM should be able to follow the law. The question is here is of balance. First of all, this is a new area for the insurance division. They are learning how to regulate PBMs, and they have reached out to PBMs, and I think the ones, you know, I know I can speak on behalf of our company, but also the other ones, I think there has been a good back and forth on trying to learn how the business model works and what exactly rises to significant concerns, what's not as concerned, what happens in the daily course. You know, there's millions and millions upon millions of prescriptions that are offered or that are written every single year. And so there's a lot of transactions that are happening. When we look at the language that has been proposed, what we're really concerned about is the absolute uncertainty of what this means. So when we look at, for example, Section 3.1 sub A, which we talked about, the condition suspend, revoke, or refuse, where the concern comes from us is what would be the circumstances where they would refuse or revoke or suspend or condition. There's nothing in the statute or in this language which gives us any indication of how this would be applied. Some would say that 23,000 complaints seems like a huge deal, and that's a system-wide problem. That's grounds for suspension or revocation. But when we look into it, maybe those 23,000 are not substantiated. Maybe these are minor transaction details that have to be worked out. So we know in other places in the statute, they clearly outline how the language should be written, how a revocation should happen, under what circumstances. Is there gross negligence, malfeasance? Is there lying? Is there financial fraud? You know, under those kind of sideboards are not in this language. And our concern is that, you know, this takes time to be able to know the industry and know our community to figure out what language would be appropriate to apply. So we've always been open to working with both you, the chair, and also the folks who have brought this legislation or this amendment forward. We recommended some language which we thought would help promote or give the agency authority to be able to enforce in the best way that they see fit, and we're still open to having those conversations. But we feel that this has the not enough detail nor sideboards to be adequate to do what the department, and I think that the folks who've offered this legislation, want to do. So, and that's just on that first piece. The language goes on. It talks about a civil penalty. We've talked about how we can be open to giving the department some authority to be able to look at how we do a penalty. However, how that penalty is applied, is it on a per prescription basis? If it was on a per prescription basis, that $10,000 per complaint could balloon up to many, many millions of dollars, because as we've seen, 23,000 complaints were filed and they were on individual transactions that happened. That's where we're concerned, is that there's just a lack of information in the amendment. But we understand the goal, and we understand what we're trying to do here, and we want to try to work towards that. as it goes on, you know, we talk about the phone number. I think it's the phone number is appropriate, that should be readily available. It's part of the law as it is currently, to make sure that that phone number is available. And if people are not supplying that phone number, then absolutely they should be held accountable for that. So, but, you know, for example, if they violate that, would that be grounds for what? That's condition, suspension, revocation? We don't know. So we're concerned about that. As we move down, into the other amendment section, on page 4, the definition of pharmacy includes an entity that provides or oversees administrative services for two or more pharmacies. So this language was alluded to when the other section that was removed, which, first of all, thank you for doing that. We think that that kind of change needs to be done in a longer legislative session, and hopefully we'll have the opportunity to have that discussion in future biennia or next year. But this language to change the definition of how pharmacies are applied, this would, if we're reading this correctly, would expand how we apply a change, or could expand how we apply a change to one individual pharmacy so that it would be applied across a much larger network or group of pharmacies. So from my understanding, pharmacies are part of what they call PSAOs, or group purchasing organizations. And when a pharmacy does appeal a price, we go through the process of determining whether that appeal should be upheld, whether there should be a change in how we reimburse the pharmacy for the cost of that drug. If this were to go into place, we possibly would have to apply that to a much larger number of pharmacies, whether or not they actually acquire the drug for a lower cost or not. So some pharmacies, if you're in rural area, or if, you know, some pharmacies are not part of a network that can get a certain price for a drug, and so they have to be reimbursed differently than those who have better access or have more expansive access to different entities that would give them a lower cost. So we take that into account when we go through the appeal process, and we're concerned that this language has more far-reaching implications than just changing the definition of the pharmacy.
That's page 4, the definition of a pharmacy.
Yes, an entity that provides or oversees administrative services for two or more pharmacies.
And how about section 8? 20 lines 23.
So my understanding is that this is more cleanup, but I have to. I want to make sure that that's the case. But that was my understanding.
Okay, so because we need to be out of here, I guess in 4 minutes, is that what you said? Regarding the first part, the enforcement. My view is that you need to have conditions, suspend, revoke, or refuse, and then in the rule process, that's where you need to be at the table, where you will be assisting with the conditions of whatever they do. That's not something that we as a legislature want to do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the only reason I say that is because there's in other areas in the statute for conditions in this, and I know we've seen it in other areas where they do have those outlined. These are the reasons why you would be able to revoke or suspend, and so that was the reference that I've seen in other areas of the statute where it actually is actually specifically outlined in statute.
But that's just my view of my intent. Would certainly not want. I wouldn't want to get involved in putting the various into statute. But anyway, questions for them,
Madam Chair. Yeah. To a degree, we don't want to leave an agency, give them carte blanche, do whatever they want to do. If there's sideboards that need to be established in statute, then those sideboards should be considered.
But we haven't been given any direction. Elise and Lisa.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, Elise Brown for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. And AHIP and Oregon members are in opposition to Senate Bill 1505 as written. And you know, it was great for Mr. Ames to walk through the enforcement piece. that you are considering right now for AHIP and AHIP members. We're still trying to understand the beginning piece of this as to the nature of the problem. You know, what are we fixing and what are we trying to enforce? One of the first things that we did, my AHIP colleague and I reached out to Mr. Blackwell at the insurance division, and he was gracious to sit down with us. We were trying to figure out, we heard about the abundance of complaints. Could you tell us what was the percentage of those that applied to Medicare Part D, and what was the percentage of those complaints that applied to the commercial insurance? Didn't have a breakdown for us, and so trying to understand, again, the magnitude of the problem. Typically, Medicare members go to CMS for those issues. So what we don't understand is if that happened, did OID, do they have a process for referring those complaints to CMS? And if they did that happen? So general statements, we feel that this is overreaching until we could uncover a little more about the nature of these complaints before we're quick to suggest a remedy that is, as John said, overreaching and precedent setting. So I have another AHIP member with me today, if you want to add.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with HealthNet Health Plan of Oregon. And I just want to add a couple of things because Jonathan covered most of them. But right now, as he indicated, there was a list of 23,000 individual prescriptions, and a good number of them, and according to Mr. Blackwell, it was 33% were Medicare, and there is nothing the Oregon State Legislature can do to regulate Medicare. But the main thing is that they have these market analysis. That's when they go in and investigate, and then they want to issue us a citation because we've violated something. And to my knowledge, they have not completed the market analysis. So to get back to Elisa's point, I don't think you're going to know in 33 days what, if there were violations, what were they? Because I think that instead of taking a shotgun, we might want to just, you know, do a targeted approach to what it is. None of us want our PBMs to violate the law. And I assure you, those of us who are regulated, and I don't care what the industry is, no one is out there knowingly, you know, doing something wrong. But until we identify what the problem is, I'm uncomfortable with a huge solution, at least for this session. And maybe we should have it definitely for 2017 to see where, if there is a pattern, where it is and how do we fix it. So thank you for your time.
Well, what I would like is to give OID or whatever their new name is, finance
DFR
tools, because and that's what I would like. I don't, and
right,
we don't want a heavy hammer. We don't want to make
right. Right.
Problems. We want to have a system that works.
So, and Madam Chair, members of the committee, we agree. I mean, we did offer language which basically described that, you know, the ECBS or DFR, whoever the agency is, if they have determined that a PBM has knowingly and purposefully violated a section of the act, then they may impose a civil penalty. But we wanted to make sure that it wasn't calculated on a per-prescription basis. And, you know, in our conversation yesterday, we spoke about, okay, well, what level could that be? And I think we're open to having that conversation because if they feel that they can't enforce the law and they're required to, then yes, I mean, they should have tools to be able to do that. But we aren't an insurance company. We don't accept risk. And so we are classified a little bit different. So taking just insurance law and applying it over may not be the best solution, and that's why we did offer at least something that would be a tool for them to be able to enforce it more effectively than they feel that they can now, even though without an identified problem, we can work towards that. We'd like to do
great. And so what I want to do, I want to meet with the proponents, but I need to now that you sort of heard at least where I'm coming from, come again with some proposed changes again, and we'll see if the proponents can come now that they have heard where you're coming from so that we can maybe have an imperfect bill, but one that will help the process.
All right.
By Thursday, Friday.
We don't meet Friday.
I meant for
meeting.
So we can get amendments in.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Right. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Is there, who else?
That's it.
So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1505, and we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.